Well, good evening. Welcome to the Digital Finance Analytics live stream for the 15th of October 2019. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, and very pleased to have you along with us for the show tonight. We've already got well over 200 on the stream, and great to see you all. Thank you very much for spending your evening with me, and I hope the next hour and a half or so will be of productive use to everybody. What I'd like to do is just go through a couple of slides to start with, just in terms of setting the agenda. And while I'm doing that, I'm not going to be looking at the live chat. So if you do have questions that you want to ask me, hold off at the moment and I'll look at them a bit later. But meantime, let's get started with a little bit of discussion around what we're going to do tonight. So just our running order to start with. This introduction, talk about the house rules, talk about our models a little bit, talk about some key slides as well, and then some questions and answers. Kelvin, thank you very much, appreciate your support. And then we'll sign off about an hour and a half, I think, probably. That's normal. In terms of house rules, please know, and I always say this isn't financial advice, it's my own opinion. Well researched, maybe, but it's not financial advice. I don't know your individual circumstances. You should get individual financial advice that's tailored to you. But nevertheless, my general observations may be helpful in terms of informing what's going on. Please play nice in the chat room. We don't want any racial slurs. The chat room is moderated and people have been booted out in the past. Don't want to do it, but we will if necessary. This is as at the 15th of October 2019, so if you're watching this on replay subsequently, who knows whether I was right or whether I was wrong, but at least, you know, there's a stake in the ground tonight. Please use Walk the World to get my attention. There's always a lot of conversation on the stream, and I encourage that, all of the side conversations, but I will make sure that I look at the Walk the World addresses, so that's the way to get my attention. You can also use Super Chat if you'd like to. That's a way of making sure that I see your question. And also, if you'd like to make a donation to help our work, all of the donations that we receive go directly back into making more content. We don't make a profit in anything we do here, but it does help us to just keep the ship on at sea and the show on the road, to mix my net metaphors. So, generally, just a couple of other little conversation points. The core analytics model is essentially what we are talking about, and this is essentially all the information from my surveys and a whole lot of other stuff too, all coming together to be able to be analysed in my core market model. 52,000 household surveys, and that feeds our surveys, the various reports, all the various YouTube channels that we put material out on, as well as client assignments as well. And we can slice and dice the data all sorts of different ways, from different property status, geography, segmentation, and all sorts of things. And that's very important in terms of getting granular. You'll hear me say often, granularity is really important because averages mask what's really going on. Now, just talking about the Reserve Bank minutes. So my headline today when I made this post was the RBA's rose-tinted spectacles are on the blink, because it's probably the most bearish minutes that I've ever seen from the Reserve Bank. And they basically said that unemployment growth would probably moderate over the subsequent few quarters, and that the unemployment rate's been at 5.25%. Remember, they were shooting for 4.5%. And also that the home loan approvals increased, but the overall growth in credit has not translated into momentum. So that's quite interesting and important. And they also made the point that there have been increases in house prices in some cities, but there's also negative equity issues, and around half of all loans are in negative equity or were in Western Australia, according to their analysis. I'll come back to that because I think that's probably too simplistic. And they also make the point that the risk from household debt, they say, remains contained. And that's partly to do with the share of interest-only loans repayment and those sorts of things. However, down the bottom there, there is a significant proportion of households that have little or no buffers, and it's around one-third of households, I think, and that's consistent with my own research. So our mortgage stress data, which we've published recently, 32.1% of households, more than a million. It's as high as it's ever been. And the other number, of course, is that household debt is 191.1 in terms of debt to income. That's from an RBA figure. And it's very, very interesting to see the fact that stress is so high. That's a third of households. A third of households are in mortgage stress. They're having difficulty making those mortgage repayments. What I mean by that is that the cash flow, money in, money out, is really tight. And they may dip into deposits. They may put more on credit cards. They may dial back on spending. This is one of the reasons why the economy is pretty weak at the moment. And we've done quite a lot of mapping. I won't go into this into detail, but you can have a look at one of our previous posts where we actually went postcode by postcode. But the thing about Sydney, this is just a Sydney example, it's eastern suburbs don't look too bad, but the western suburbs of Sydney, right the way from Blacktown and Campbelltown and places like that, that's where the mortgage stress is really very high as a proportion of total households. And that really doesn't bode well, because we were seeing similar signs to this over in Mandurah a couple of years ago, and things have got much worse over in the West since then. And you can also see that it's not just one or two segments. Young growing families, 54% are registered with a financial shortfall in our research. But we've also got battling urban and disadvantaged FRIMS groups that also have significant exposure, but also exclusive professionals. These are the top end of the market, you know, the more affluent households. 24.7% of those have difficulty with cash flow. A lot of those have multiple mortgages, interest-only loans and things. And just over 22.6% of our suburban mainstream households, that's our main segment, the biggest segment, are also in difficulty. So it's quite widely based, this stress. And I won't go into this detail, but 2560, which includes Campbelltown, is the most stressed postcode. Then 6065, which includes Tapping and Wanneroo over in the west. And third, 4350, which includes Toowoomba. And fourth includes Liverpool. And fifth includes Narrawarren and Fountain Gate. Now, the thing that characterises most of these is that they are very high new development with on the urban fringe, large, very large property and very small lots, and often bought in the last 3 to 5 years. And now moving beyond that, just the mortgage default data that came out today. This is from the SPIN data from Standard & Poor. And basically they said that overall mortgage delinquency dropped slightly, but that's most, they think, to do with the fact that income tax cuts have come through and also some people have refinanced. But the 90-day default is still looking pretty shaky. And over in the West, it's measured at 2.75%. New South Wales, 1.24. South Australia is 1.41. And the Northern Territory, 2.72. And Queensland is 1.79. So these aren't big numbers. And the issue I have is that the interest rate's ultra low, but yet we have significant questions around default. And in fact, the Reserve Bank, in their financial stability report, made the point that the highest proportion of those in mortgage arrears was actually in Western Australia. And what they went on to say that one of the things that has really happened is that it's not so much more loans going into arrears, but essentially households, once they're in arrears, are finding it much harder to resolve the situation than previously. And in fact, banks have been quite lenient in terms of dealing with this, which has contributed to an increase in the longer term arrears rates. But what the Reserve Bank went on to say was that the banks will need to actually tighten down on that. Otherwise, they're going to be financial stability risks later. So we could well see more foreclosures ahead. And the final point on this one is that more than half of loans in arrears in Western Australia have negative equity. And negative equity is something we'll see a lot more of. Bear in mind, though, that the negative equity here is based on average data from the Reserve Bank's securitization portfolios. And those securitization pools are not necessarily precisely the same as the total market. So I think they've cherry-picked the loans to go in securitized pools. So whatever we see in securitized pools, I think more broadly it'll be worse. The confidence index fell again, so household confidence is pretty wobbly. It's actually lower than it's been ever, and we discussed that, I think, a few times. I'm going to skip over the next couple of slides simply because it's just one of those things we keep saying. But this is other information out today. The latest ANZ Roy Morgan said that the confidence level was down again 1.2% over the last week. This is last week in the second straight weekly loss. And it's running below its long-term average. And whilst the financial conditions sub-indices were a little positive, and that's to do with lower interest rates, the weakness in the economy is really beginning to shove through in those data points. And the time to buy a household item measure fell by 3.9% after two successive gains. And so, again, it goes to the same point. Households are less able and willing to spend. And, of course, business confidence is also falling. This is from Westpac. So both business and household confidence is pretty wobbly. And retail is, wilting, as are dwelling commencements. So both construction and retail are under pressure. We're seeing a lot of job pressures in those particular segments. And the trade balance, of course, which has saved us up till now, well, it was positive again in August at 5.9, but down. And that's because the iron ore price has come off and we're going to see more of that. So essentially the household and business sectors are not supporting the economy. What is supporting the economy is the trade balance and also government expenditure into infrastructure. But of course, the trade balance is now coming off. And therefore, the question is, where's the economy going? It's going to get weaker, I think, ahead. Now, the new lending flows were higher this last time around. But of course, if you look over the last couple of months, there was a bit of a spike, but it looks to me to be plateauing out now. And it was pretty much across the board, other than owner-occupied new builds. They were very weak, but a bit of a spike in investment refinancing. And that's the point. Where people can refinance, they will refinance. And the fact of the matter is, the more people refinance, it puts more pressure on bank margins, because the bank margins on old loans were better than the new loans that are being written. And whilst it may help some households to be able to get a lower interest rate, many households in difficulty, negative equity, financial stress, are unable to refinance, so they're imprisoned on higher rates at the moment. And that said, overall credit growth continues to slow. Still housing at 3.1%, that's the lowest it's been forever, and investment lending is very low. This is the Reserve Bank data. So this is at the aggregate level, so this is the stock of loans. So there's very little evidence yet of the new loans coming through, lifting loan growth. And in fact, this means that more people are paying off debt and paying down loans because they're more concerned about the future. And just on CoreLogic, they say property prices are going up, and they've segmented it by the lower, middle and upper. So in Sydney over the last quarter, up more than 4%, Melbourne 4.6%, other places not as much, although Perth down. But of course, there's another question now as to whether these indicators are accurate or not. And you may have seen my interview with the chief economist at REA, who basically said that they weren't seeing yet these same increases, and hypothesised that there was some growth in some areas, particularly in the eastern suburbs and top end of the market, but western suburbs and units, no real growth. So there are some open questions, I think, about precisely the state of home price information. Remember that we don't get the value or general information until 3 months later, so we won't really know what the true story is for another 3 months or so. And in the meantime, we're reliant on index from private sources, and some are reporting significant growth areas and some are not. So who knows? And I'll just comment quickly on QE. We'll come back to this later. There's quite a lot of questions on QE. But, you know, quantitative easing is likely in Australia. Philip Lowe published a couple of papers in his BIS role talking about the need for quantitative easing around the world and the fact that it could be a valid strategy, providing it was linked with fiscal strategy too. But other people have been questioning whether, in fact, the low-rate monetary policy can survive and will it implode. And there are bankers in Europe who've now sent a memorandum to the ECB, the European Central Bank, saying it's not working. You've had low rates for a long time. Banks are not lending. In fact, banks are just preferring to prop up businesses and households rather than deal with foreclosures that they should be dealing with. And they're less able to take their deposit rates down because deposit rates cannot go to zero. And basically the guys in Europe are saying it's not working. And of course, it's not really working around the world. So the point is there, you move into QE, negative interest rates, etc., but there's no way back. And that's the concern I have, that I think we're going down the same route in Australia. Now, just in terms of our scenarios, again, driven by our core market model, we look at this just to sort of understand what's going on, experimenting with different scenarios. We're not predicting necessarily one scenario or the other scenario is the right one. We're just saying here's a range of different things. Things change. We update the models every month. I ran the update today, so this is the first time this information has been disseminated through the DFA channel. And as normal, we look at business as usual, which is the sort of the RBA best estimates as to what I think may happen based on what the RBA is thinking. Then I've got things going to get better, not yet doomsday, the Armageddon scenario. and the doomsday scenario. Just to explain that, the first couple are basically local created issues and opportunities, and then as we come down the list there, the international circumstances and the issue relating to potentially to recessions in the US or Europe coming over the top. And as we come down the list, Armageddon is when banks are bailed out, as what happened in Ireland, so it's Ireland 2.0. Doomsday, like Iceland, is when banks are not bailed out and they are allowed to crash. So this is the first one. I certainly updated my unemployment rate this time. I think it's going to be 5.2%, 5.25%. I think the bank losses will be a little bit higher. But given what I'm seeing in the market and what the Reserve Bank has said they are prepared to do, and the loosening of the lending standards and the fact that the banks have, for example, Westpac's taken their floor rate down again in the last couple of weeks, I'm now suggesting that in this scenario, we could see home prices based on the baseline of September 2018, 2 years ahead, up 8 to 12%. That's more than I said last time. So there is a path to higher home prices if, in fact, the Reserve Bank is able to do its QE and, you know, easing credit. The consequences, of course, later will be very significant and worrying, insofar that I think probably prices will go up, but then actually come back. And I'm giving it now a 20% probability, last time a 10% probability, simply because of all of the noise that the Reserve Bank has been made. They cut rates again. They're likely to cut rates either in November or February again. And then they're likely to do QE per Phil Lowe's recent papers. So that's my sort of baseline RBA scenario. However, I think that's quite unlikely. I think that we're going to see unemployment rising rather than falling from this point, and it's more likely that the construction sector and the retail sector will continue to get into more difficulty. As a result of that, mortgage stress will go up. As a result of the bank, losses will rise. As a result of that, we'll start to see home prices tapering down again, and in two years' time or so, I think they're going to be 10 to 15 down from where they were baselined back in September 2018. And in this strategy, you've got easing credit rules, fiscal stimulus and QE without really anything coming out the back. And this is sort of a bit of equivalent, I think, to what was happening in Europe. And I think it could well happen here. 25% probability down from 30% last time. The next one is not yet doomsday. So now this is where we get some of the international pressures coming over the top. And remember that 70% of economists in the US are still predicting a recession in the US. China could come off. Brexit could still blow up. Lots of other things around the world are actually looking quite wobbly. In this scenario, unemployment is even higher. Mortgage stress is even higher. Bank losses are higher. And as a result of that, home prices could slide further. One bank in that scenario would not be able to survive without being bailed in or bailed out in some way. 25% probability on that one. And then if it gets really bad, this is like the GFC 2.0 effectively, interest rates will go even lower. We might even get into zero interest rate territory, but unemployment will be a lot higher. Mortgage stress will be higher. Bank losses will be higher. And home prices essentially would be coming way off. This would take home prices back to their fundamental value, because in Australia, home prices are averaged about 40% over where they should be in absolute real terms. And we were looking at bail-ins and bailouts and QE2 and all those things, 25% probability. And then the final one, which would be doomsday, this is where banks are allowed to fail. I think it's highly unlikely that banks in Australia will be allowed to fail. I think they will be bailed out one way or the other by the government. But if it was a global thing and lots of banks around the world were failing, it would be difficult to do that. Liquidity would be under pressure. And so in that scenario, rates would be very low. Unemployment would be very, very high. Mortgage stress would be dramatic. And losses would be high. Home prices would be significantly down from where they are. Very unlikely, only 5% probability. And you can see there that the middle of the road story would then be, you know, we're looking at very low interest rates. Unemployment is the key question. Is it going to go up? Is it going to go down? If it's going to go up, then we could see home prices really begin to slide again. If, in fact, we don't see that and unemployment goes down, wages start to move up, then we could see home prices continue to move up a little from where they were back in September 2018. So that's my latest and greatest view of what's happening in the marketplace and how my scenarios work. Okay, with that, let me go back now to the question and answers. And firstly, I just want to say thank you to all those who've been contributing, and there were a number of people who made Super Chat donations. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. It is Glenys, thank you for that. Really appreciate it. And I think there was one or two others too, which I'll try and locate. Jovia, thank you so much. I really appreciate your support, and it really does make a huge difference to us being able to do what we want to do on this channel. Okay, now, Kerry asked a question. Do you think Asian countries other than China will benefit much from the US-China trade dispute? Well, it's an interesting question, that. So there's a few things to say. Firstly, there was a huge sort of enthusiasm at the end of last week and over the weekend, because basically there was a sort of a preliminary agreement on phase one of the trade agreement. Well, in principle, they've still got to work it out. But I don't know whether you saw, but today China basically said, yeah, but there's still issues we want to have tackled. And so I think these negotiations are going to go up and down, up and down, up and down. Now, the US is also, of course, negotiating with other countries in terms of bilateral trade agreements. And so the issue is, if in fact the China-US agreement does get locked in, then essentially that could take some of the pain off the table. If it doesn't, or if it just bubbles along, then that could lead to an opportunity for other smaller countries to perhaps come in and be an alternative provider of services or goods. But of course, the issue is that if in fact the confidence level degrades further and global growth is expected to be much lower than was predicted even 6 months ago, partly because of the trade wars, then it becomes a vicious circle rather than a virtuous circle. And what that means essentially is that more countries will get into more difficulty, and there'll be more fallout, and international trade will begin to unwind even further. And it becomes then a question as to whether the international trade rules can hold together, or whether in fact we're going to see more and more bilateral and a decomposition of those international rules. If that happens, then I think the overall outlook for the economy is even more serious and negative. So the short answer is, I think it's unlikely that a lot of other countries are going to benefit in the short term. With one caveat, I think India might be able to come up behind some on some things, but we'll see. They're somewhere off that yet. Okay, let's go and see what else we've got. DIY. What happened to part two video on derivatives? I know. Look, I've just run out of runway. I have been so busy on doing so many other things and creating all the other shows. I do have all of the content to record, and there will be another show on derivatives. And in fact, I want to do the rest of my capital market series in the future. I've got all the material, as I say. It's just a matter of time and effort to be able to firstly put all the graphics together, and then secondly to record the shows. But I haven't forgotten. I've just been rather busy. And look, to be honest, part of the issue is that the market has just been so volatile and so difficult for some long time that I haven't really had the chance to be able to deal with the things that I perhaps would want to do. Okay, Vanessa said, any update on the cash ban restriction bill? Right, so as you may know, it's gone to the Senate. Essentially, there's a submission date of the middle of next month, middle of November, to put in more submissions to the Senate inquiry. That will go through till, I think, February next year. What's interesting is that there has been more and more resistance from the backbench around this, and there was some interesting articles. The Saturday paper, for example, over the weekend did quite a big article on the cash ban and some of the issues around it. There seems to be a well of support to lobby against it. And so I'd encourage anybody who feels so moved to put a submission in to the Senate. What I'm doing is I'm building effectively another piece of collateral, which I will then send across to the Senate, and I'll make it available on the YouTube channel, but not probably until early November, because what I don't want to do is to set, if you like, a single agenda for everybody. But if you believe, as I do, that the $10,000 cash ban is more about negative interest rates and controlling cash and the erosion of civil liberties rather than actually dealing with tax leakage or gangs or things like that, The thing that you need to understand is that in this latest iteration from the government, they've really amped up the tax leakage and you know, looking to make sure that the taxes that should be paid are being paid, but they can't quantify how much that represents. So it really is not a very powerful argument. And I've got a lot of feedback from all sorts of people. For example, a lot of farmers out in the bush and other people who, as part of their business today, use cash day in, day out, week in, week out. And they also make the point quite frequently is that quite often the electronic systems go down, like, you know, the ATMs go down or the FPOS machines go down. And without cash, there's no way of actually paying for things. So essentially, their view is, and I agree with them, that taking cash away is very significant and very worrying and frankly, is more about, you know, controlling rather than actually dealing with real issues. Remember that the total amount we're talking about is quite low in terms of what I think the tax benefits will be, based on what I've seen. But again, government can't quantify. Also make the point that in New Zealand they did an inquiry invitation for people to put submissions in about cash and the use of cash, and the Reserve Bank in New Zealand came back and said there's been a very significant, there's more than 2,000 that they had for their submissions, 2,000 submissions, and a lot of people were very strongly advocating for the retention of cash and the use of cash. So it'll be interesting to see where Reserve Bank of New Zealand goes to. Okay, what else have we got? Okay, Madeline, what was the purpose of your speaking with the fund and hedge managers? Okay, so that was an invitation that I had to go and speak to a range of local and international people watching the Australian market, and essentially to give them my perspective on what was going on. And it was a sort of a quite an open dialogue in terms of you know, sharing views and opinions about the economy. I have to say that most of the people in the room were similarly aligned to me in terms of what they're seeing. There was very little real enthusiasm for home price growth, very little evidence to see it. There was a lot of views that the banks here in Australia are still probably overpriced and the risks are probably higher. And so I got quite a lot out of it in terms of hearing what those people were thinking about the situation. And I was also able to explain to them what I was seeing from my perspective in terms of some of the issues that I've been seeing recently in the marketplace. So it was an exchange of views. I sort of hummed and hawed a bit about, you know, do I put it up, don't I put it up? But I thought, well, there's enough really interesting conversation there, I think, to make it worthwhile to put up. And quite a few people have been quite appreciative of being a fly on the wall and just hearing some of those discussions. I did edit out some pieces from the 1 hour, 1 and a quarter hours that I spoke for because of some of the other questions that were asked and because of the fact that I didn't necessarily want other people to be identified. But that was the purpose of it. And I do this from time to time. I'm happy to share my views through any forum if people you know, are interested. But most of the time I do it virtually. But in this particular circumstance, I went up to Sydney and I thought I'd make a blog of it, hence the thing that I recorded yesterday and posted. Okay. Questions. Okay. What level of defaults is Happy Robot? What level of defaults would set us in serious trouble? 33% in stress already? If those 33% defaulted, what would happen? Yeah. So look, the fact of the matter is the level of default, you know, if it's sort of, you know, 1 or 2% at the moment. If you look in the US, they had default rates of up to 15% through the global financial crisis. In some areas, it was much higher than that. And what that basically means is that there is a significant risk above a certain level. Now, the difference between mortgage stress, which is people muddling through and being able to manage their cash flow but hunkering down and spending less, and defaulting is you know, a determinant by level of employment. Unemployment in the West has risen. That's one of the reasons why we've now got much higher levels of default. And also the fact that when people have got negative equity, they can't really sell and get out. And as I said earlier on, a lot of the banks in the West have been very generous in their supporting of households through these difficult times. But at some point, the worm will turn, because essentially the Reserve Bank said it tonight, as I recited their minutes from earlier on, that the banks will need to tighten down. So my own view is that if you start seeing defaults at 3 or 4 or 5, that's really serious enough to really be quite difficult. And, you know, 2.75% in the West at the moment is roughly what I'm seeing. In some postcards, it's 8%. Now, if we start seeing that over down the East Coast, and I'm particularly looking at the western suburbs of Sydney and some of the areas around Melbourne and also up in Brisbane as well, that's going to be serious. Okay, let's have a look. Somebody else made a contribution. Thank you very much. I just need to trace who. Who's that? Okay, let's have a look. Okay, George has asked, if the Aussie QE happens and increases money supply by, let's say, 5%, and wage growth was tied to this 5%, wouldn't this wage growth help overcome mortgage stress? So, yeah, what you're talking about, so the point is, what is the mode of QE that we might see, right? And if you look at what's happened in the States and around the world, the QE has not flowed through to helping the real economy. What it's done is it's provided more liquidity to the banks, but in some cases, for example, in Europe, the banks have sat on that liquidity and really haven't lent it. And so we haven't seen a significant spike in business investment, nor indeed in a household wealth. The question that you've got to come back to is, does QE really translate into wealth for the people? And the answer is no, it doesn't. I don't think it does, not the way it's being envisaged. And neither the version of QE that the Fed is now doing, which is effectively repo rate based, which, by the way, to answer another question I had before the show, yeah, that's still QE. It's just a different sort of QE, despite what Jerome Powell said. These are stimulations applied to the financial sector to try and support the financial sector. It creates asset bubbles, so effectively the stock markets goes up, which is why people love it. The bond market, of course, love it, because people with bonds will actually see the price of those bonds continue to rise, and that means they can make massive profits. A lot of people in the US are positioned with those bonds. But in terms of the real economy, it doesn't work. The right answer towards providing direct stimulation for the economy, I think, is more to do with helicopter money or money into the hands of consumers. But there's very little, I suspect, intent to do that, certainly in the short term. Rudd, of course, did it a decade plus ago to an extent, although whether that was well placed is a different conversation. But no, there is no direct correlation between wages growth and QE. In fact, if there's a lot of QE with asset prices rising, people will find it even more difficult to buy, for example, property, and the financial pressures on households will grow. Bear in mind also that it will take interest rates even lower, and that whilst that may help people with mortgages a little, anybody with a deposit sitting in a bank, they're seeing almost no returns, and that's been a very negative impact. 3 million households rely on some sort of returns from deposits, and the surveys that I run show that more of those households are struggling now simply because the deposit rates are way down. Oh, okay. Audio appears to be clipping off fairly irregularly. Chris, that's interesting. Thank you for that. It's showing quite okay at my end. If anybody else is having issues with the audio, would you just make a post and let me know? Just going down the list of questions, see what else there is there. Okay, this is Damien. Hi, Martin. Any views on the digital neobanks such as Vault Bank? Safer deposits, they have less derivatives. Challenger banks, the more likely to pass on interest rate cuts. Yeah, very interesting question. The Big Four and the regionals are definitely the ones with a lot of the issues at the moment, not least because, of course, the big four have a lot of derivatives exposure. And there's been a spike in derivatives on their books. It's 48 trillion now. That's a significant rise. And that's because a lot of them are taking positions and essentially trying to make money out of trading. ANZ in its last results reported a significant increase in trading income, for example. So those big organizations are using derivatives to essentially try and generate additional revenue, which means they're more exposed. Regional banks, they have the worst case because they probably won't have the same ability to be able to actually command funding, and they'll have to pay more for their funding, firstly. And secondly, they don't have any scale benefits. And some of their underwriting standards, in my view, look a little bit less than perfect, shall I say. So I tend to think that some of those regional banks are also likely to experience some pressure. I am more interested in some of the smaller mutual banks, and I still think some of those are actually doing a much better job. They don't have the same profit pressure. They don't have the same derivatives exposure. They have more manageable books. And in fact, the underwriting processes tend to be in some ways more manual, but that may not be a bad thing. And they're also smaller, so therefore they don't have some of the scale issues. But the new banks, the neobanks, it's very early to tell. Remember that quite a few of these have limited banking licenses so far. They'll probably develop later. They certainly don't have derivatives, and some of the product pricing that they have doesn't look too bad. So I would say shop around. I certainly think that the mutuals and some of the neobanks are probably a better bet than the big guys. Okay, what else have we got? Just looking down the list. A lot of conversations going on. Okay, here we go. Right, this is from Fossil 25. Will the government's reaction to banks not passing no on, you should be on the rate cuts, actually have any effect? No, it probably won't. The announcement on Monday was precisely a similar story that was actually there 2 years ago and 1 year ago. The Productivity Commission has done a report and the ACCC did a report. The ACCC and the Productivity Commission both made two points. One, mortgage rates are impossible to understand because the quoted rate is never the rate you get. And the discount processes are very untransparent. And two, that existing loan holders are almost always paying more than new borrowers. And in fact, banks rely on it because essentially what they're trying to do is to discount deeply new loans to people to try and increase the flow of loans on their books. Whereas, of course, people with existing mortgages would love to see their rates come down. And the issue is that I don't think this is going to change unless you get some sort of regulatory intervention, which I would be surprised about, because ultimately, you know, this is meant to be a relatively free market, ho-ho. Most of the big banks, of course, look at each other and sort of march in step. A few smaller players might vary the rates a little. But we've got two fundamental problems. If banks did actually translate the rate cuts to everybody, then their margin would be madly compressed. Secondly, there's a massive disconnect between the cash rate and where that moves and the average funding rate for the banks, particularly the big banks, because they get a lot of their funding from overseas and those funding rates have not moved the same way. And there's also a floor below which they can't take deposit rates lower simply because people won't hold money in the banks. They'll simply take it out and hold it outside the banking system in safe. In fact, look, in Japan, when rates went really low, it was safe builders and safe retailers that actually won on that, because basically more people got a safer home and then put the money in the safe, which is why the cash ban is connected to it, right? Because effectively they need to stop money being able to be taken out of the system into cash. Otherwise, once it's out there, then essentially it can't be controlled. So my own view is there's going to be very little difference this time. And what I should be interested to see is whether, in fact, the bank's justifications, which is that the international funding is different from the cash rate, which is correct, and also the fact that they've got to try to balance the needs of depositors, shareholders, and borrowers. The fact is that it's the shareholders who are putting significant pressure on the banks to maintain their margins and to maintain their returns. A lot of those shareholders are international hedge funds and international foreign players. So, you know, whilst everybody says, well, a lot of the money goes back to mum and dad investors in Australia, some does, a lot of it doesn't. A lot of it goes to institutional investors. And institutional investors are absolutely pushing hard the banks to maintain their margins and to maintain their shareholder returns, because up till quite recently, Australian banks had very good returns relative to players internationally. And my own modelling suggests that we're going to see margin pressure continuing to build, and therefore the banks will continue to play these shenanigans with rates. And what I'd say to anybody with a mortgage, it's worth shopping around and seeing whether you can find a cheap one. You probably will be able to. You have to bear in mind things like the cost of transferring and those things. But if you've not looked around in the last few months, it's worth doing, because you can probably save quite a lot of money. Okay, Phil says, do you think consumer spending could have been affected by over 1 million sales of the Barefoot Investor leading people to be more frugal? I don't know, interesting question. We certainly know that households are not spending, and we know that it's not a question of one factor, it's multiple factors. So my surveys say people are very worried about the broader economy, people's incomes are not growing, the cost of living are growing very fast and very hard, and they're also saying that the forward uncertainty in terms of employment prospects means that they want to be very cautious. In fact, many are paying debt down because the argument is that with uncertainty, paying debt down gives you more flexibility. I actually agree with that, by the way. I think that's a good strategy. So in a way, paying debt down and being more frugal is not necessarily a bad strategy. But of course, it has the negative impact on the economy. And by the way, if you think about what the Reserve Bank's perspective, they actually don't want people to save, they want people to spend, right? They want people to spend big, because essentially they want the economy to turn over more, to grow bigger, and therefore to be inflating, and therefore they can meet their inflation target of 2 to 3%. The really interesting question is, in fact, is a inflation target of 2 to 3% in the current environment anything like right, or are we effectively just messing around with numbers that really are meaningless now? Remember that inflation is undermeasured. We've discussed this on several occasions in the past. Remember also that one of the ways to get inflation up is to let the exchange rate drop, and I think that's what will happen. That will import inflation into Australia. But I've got a much more fundamental question, which is an inflation targeting mentality in the current environment actually helping or not? And my own view is it probably is taking us down the wrong path. Okay. Genevieve has come in and said, heard that the total derivatives now worldwide is 1.5 quadrillion. Well, it's huge. Look, there's lots of different ways of measuring the total amount of derivatives in the system. And you can basically measure each contract in isolation and sort of total them all up. I think the 1.5 quadrillion there is probably, you know, that's as good an estimate as any. Others will say, but yeah, you can offset, you know, one on the other, and therefore there's a net number, which is quite a lot smaller. Or you can actually argue for a closed out position, and the net is then effectively just even smaller again. I find interesting that the BIS now have stopped publishing the total number of derivatives. They only now talk about the total volume turned over each day, which is growing, by the way. And I think that this derivatives issue is huge. I've said for some time that it's probably one of the most concerning aspects of the banking system and the way it works currently. I've been saying also that, you know, separating the operation of the banks between the trading and speculative operations and the core lending and deposit holding is absolutely essential. That's Glass-Steagall, of course. The fact of the matter is, at the moment, the BIS that I mentioned earlier on in one of their recent reports said that one of the things that banks do when they go into low interest rates environment is to spend more time and energy speculating and taking positions, which is precisely what we're seeing. So there is no surprise to me that we're seeing more derivatives, not less at the moment, because people are taking positions and trying to speculate and trying to effectively generate income from trading activities. But it's highly risky. And the problem is that if there's actually a significant mismatch or a significant financial collapse somewhere, one of the big banks, for example, that will have a knock-on effect, and that will effectively put the banking system into shock again, just like the GFC. And then comes the question, yes, but then how do you actually deal with a bank that's struggling? And that's when you get into the bail-in and bail-out conversations that we've had already before. We have to separate those two sets of activities, in my view, for this to actually not be a significant international traffic accident. But it's a huge number, impossibly large. And my own view is that the derivatives is an absolutely ticking time bomb. It's just a question of when, not if. Frank the One, thank you very much. Appreciated your contribution there. 5% deposit first home buyers from January 2020 will push push property prices up. Yeah, a bit maybe. The thing about these first time buyer incentives is that it lifts the boat on prices. So basically, prices just rise by the amount of the availability. Remember, there are only 10,000 loans, I think, which will be available. So it's not going to be everywhere, and it's going to be spread across the country. So I think that the effect will be noticeable but limited, frankly. And I also noticed that there are less first-time buyers now in my surveys expressing an interest in transacting relative to previous. So it may well be that the impact is less. I guess it also depends on the international situation at the time too. Okay, and there was another question there from Jody. Again, thank you very much for the super chat. What are your views on shared equity loans? Are they good to stay with? Well, the experience in the UK is that shared equity loans have not worked very, very well, insofar that it is all predicated on capital growth. And whilst we had capital growth in Australia for a generation or two, that's a bit abnormal. And certainly in the UK now, quite a few people who took equity loans in the 3 to 5 year horizon have seen no capital growth. And they've now come to the end of those equity loans and basically have now to refinance onto a proper loan, and their payments are going up and they're having difficulty. So it's certainly not a straightforward and easy ask, I think. The other point there is that with an equity loan, you're taking the risk. So essentially, if prices do fall, then you're losing your share and your ability to be able to then effectively change and get out later. And again, in the UK, there is stories of people locked into particular properties with particular loans because effectively they haven't performed as expected. So it does add extra complexity, and I've been quite sceptical personally of the benefit of equity loans. Robbie Barwick says, glass Steagall now. Hear, hear. Yes, well, this is really, really important. The separation of those sporty activities from the meat and potato activities would actually have a huge benefit in terms of reducing risk in the system, but also it would enable banks to lend to businesses. And the thing that I'm very concerned about at the moment is that finance for business is very, very hard to get hold of. So again, my surveys, my SME surveys, more and more households are absolutely under the pump, but businesses even more so. And businesses are saying, we just can't get the money. We can't get the cash to be able to get our business to work. I'd also make the point that many businesses are also saying, and we don't have enough business forward to be able to essentially warrant investment too. So there's a need to see some uptick, but also a need to make more finance available. One of the things that people talk about is a national bank, a bank that's deliberately set up to try and help households and businesses with the finance that they need, and not go down the rabbit hole of speculation and international financing and all those other things. I think there's a big merit, a lot of merit in that. This is from DYL. 60-year-old mum has about 40k in super, so is limited as to retirement housing. I'm telling her to wait, but she desperately wants to buy while still employed. How high could rates go in the future? Very, very interesting question. Look, I'm pretty sure that we're going to see interest rates very, very low for a long time. There is a risk of hyperinflation later if the dollar really does depreciate strongly. And you could look around some of the African countries to see what could happen. And then we could get hyperinflation, and that could then see interest rates rise significantly later. But I think at the moment, you know, the next few years, we're going to live in a very low interest rate environment. Remember that in Japan, rates have been at zero or below for, you know, a significant amount of time, as indeed they are, of course, in the UK as well. And whilst central banks have tried to try and push rates up, the markets have effectively been successful in getting them to keep rates lower again. And it's that central bank versus the market tussle, which I think will keep rates low for a long period of time. My concern is, though, that low rates and then quantitative easing essentially creates a dead end. Essentially, it doesn't solve the fundamental issue, which was too much debt a decade or so ago. Banks that were never actually sort of sorted. So effectively, they've got more capital now, but they've still got the same sort of issues they had previously. And very little has changed in a decade plus. And so the chances of this getting fixed and rates taking off anytime soon is quite limited, I think, now. Remember that the Reserve Bank 6 months ago, a year ago, was saying rates will likely go up. Now they're saying rates will likely go down. My modelling is more on the downside than the upside at the moment. Okay, what else? Michael, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Do you see property prices falling from the outer suburbs first, thus inner and more reasonable locations hold their prices better? Yeah, I think that's right. What I'm seeing at the moment in terms of home prices is that there are pockets where prices are very strong. A lot of those are in the inner city suburban areas where people are buying houses, not units, particularly on quite large plots. And those prices are very, very significant. Plus, the top end of the marketplace, like Vaucluse, very, very strongly up. But they really are not connected to mortgage directly. They're, you know, that's more to do with the broader finances that are around there. So in that inner area, there is definitely movement. There are definitely falls in units, and those units are both close in and further out across the Sydney and Melbourne basins, seeing somewhat similar now in some areas of Brisbane. That's because there's too much supply of units, concerns about the construction quality and defects and flammable cladding. Adelaide reported 30 high-rise with issues. We know there are issues in Canberra. We know there are issues in Darwin. We know there are issues on the Gold Coast as well. So this is quite widespread. So I think unit prices under pressure, plus there's more supply coming on stream. And there's been a lot of attempts to try and get people to buy units unsuccessfully. A lot of them being sold now abroad unsuccessfully. So I think that's going to be downward. And then you look at the outer suburban houses on the new estates. And again, so far, I haven't seen very much evidence of real price turns. Generally, there are a few pockets, but generally, those properties are still significantly down than where they were. In some cases, we're seeing 30% down. And we're also not seeing much chance of them recovering because the amount of stress in those areas are very high as well. And that basically just makes it less and less likely that people are going to be able to deal with the whole issue of buying and selling in those areas. There's also a lot of people whose employment prospects are weakening and whose financial position is worsening in those areas too. So I think we're going to see a pivot. We're going to see some areas close in continue to rise, in the short term at least, maybe then settling back later. In the western suburbs of Sydney and in the sort of outer suburban areas of Melbourne, like Narrawarra and places like that, somewhat similar story. Less dramatic movements probably in Brisbane, although some. In some regional areas, we're already seeing some recovery, but also quite a lot of depression, particularly among units. See that locally here down in around Wollongong, up in Newcastle. And up in Queensland and in Western Australia, we're seeing a very mixed picture. There are a few postcodes where things are improving, but a lot of postcodes where they're not. And prices have come off dramatically over in the West, for example. In some postcodes, they're 30% down already. So it's a very mixed picture. And I don't think there's enough evidence to really suggest that there's going to be widespread uplifts. So it's going to be pockets. It's going to be particular types of property in very, prestigious areas, perhaps. But, meat and potato properties, second tier properties, less so. Remember that the supply is very limited as well, so we have got very little supply coming on stream at the moment, unlike what I thought was going to happen a couple of months ago from my surveys. People got cold feet and didn't list. So I suspect that we're going to see low supply. Property prices will then rise in those areas, whereas in fact the supply in other locations is much better and prices are much weaker. Okay, this is Chris. Do you see interest rates ever going up for savers? From this point, it's very unlikely that we're going to see savings rates improve very much at all. The UK experience is that many people over in the UK have saving rates below 0.5% and they've had it for 10 years. And that's including on term deposits. So there are a few now offering, you know, one and one and a bit, but many, many significantly less than that. It's hard to see a path for savers. And, you know, one of the things I talk about is the fact that savers ultimately will start have to eat, will eat into their capital because they are not going to make sufficient from their capital to be able to live off. And that's a very, very depressing and disconcerting situation for people who had thought that they saved enough through their superannuation or through, you know, other means to be able to actually see them through their retirement. And now effectively the capital value of that is being eroded. The returns on those are very low and I can't see a way back. What's very interesting is that many people in my survey say, yeah, we are not going to take higher risk. We're not going to go into the stock markets. We're not going to buy property because we just think the risks are too high. But then, of course, the question is, well, what do you do? What do you do if you, in fact, expect rates to stay low and your returns are very, very, very compressed? I can't see a way back from that with the current RBA settings. They, you know, frankly, the RBA has let the country down badly. I think they've actually blown their mandate, which was to look after all Australians. I think they've forgotten that they're there to do that. They've been fixated on the financial system and the inflation targeting very myopically, but then central banks around the world have been doing that for a long time too. They've lost the plot, and there is very little accountability to the Reserve Bank. They don't even actually have to stump up under oath to the Parliament, you know. So there's very little accountability, and I'm afraid that I regard many of their decisions over the last 5 to 8 years as completely inappropriate. And they've led us into this corner, which is looking extremely uncomfortable for savers. People with long mortgages may have a little bit of leeway because rates are so low. But then if unemployment continues to rise, it's going to be tough anyway. Okay, Forcible 25. I can't give you financial advice, but basically, you know, she's got some land out west, right? 50 years ago, bought the land 50 years ago, needs to sell soon. Should you do it now before the crash or wait till the rebound? Depends how quickly you need to sell it. Look, prices out the west, many land prices have dropped by 50% over in the west since 2 or 3 years ago. So property prices aren't that flash at the moment. The question is, will there be much of a rebound? And over what time frame? My own view is that there could be a little bit of momentum in the early part of next year, but it's likely to ebb away again as the broader economic issues play out. So I think it's very tricky to make a call on that at the moment. What I would say is that you know, check to see what current land prices are in the around the area, and if there is any short-term improvement, it might be worth giving it a shot. But I wouldn't expect top dollar. Sovereign Borders says our lack of economic complexity will make it very difficult for us to recover. Well, I agree with that, yeah. And, you know, there are a number of other people talking about this, so I won't go right the way through the argument. But basically, we've had a very simple business model, which is to dig up resources and ship them overseas, sell livestock and other agribusinesses, and not much else. We have a very, very problematic economy insofar that our growth engines are pretty much bust. We're reliant on the price of iron ore. We're reliant on people taking those and using them abroad, plus coal and oil and those sorts of things, all of which is very exposed. It's exposed from an environmental standpoint. It's exposed from a demand standpoint. And the overall complexity in the economy is extremely low. And we have very little focus on innovation, very little focus on, you know, new things. And I think that's been a government mistake for 20 years plus. I'm afraid that I think Howard and Costello were partly responsible. They should have actually invested some of those mining funds that were coming through into some future operations rather than just giving it away by way of tax breaks. And the political cycle has then meant that it's not been possible to deal with that. We have to find a plan B if we're going to actually deal with our economy, I think. Okay, and recession 1920. What's the news from the Real Estate Inquiry? Short answer is I'm not sure what I know what you're talking about. You'll have to tell me more about that. Don't know about that. Okay, let's go down the list. Oh, here we are. Okay, this is from Innocenti 1. Martin, is the zero bound close by? How can we continue with such amounts of debt sucking the blood out of the economy? Well, yeah, so you're preaching my gospel, right? So I'm of the belief that we've got too much debt in the economy. We're at 191, as I showed you earlier on, or more than 100% of household debt to GDP. And those are very big numbers. What it's doing is it's sucking the lifeblood out of the economy, absolutely. Now, I know that debt is more serviceable because rates are really low. And so there are people out there who say, look, it's easy because rates are so low, people can service much bigger amounts of debt. But I have to make the point, debt still has to be repaid. And that's what people keep forgetting, right? So you can hold a big debt for a long period of time. If there's very little inflation, the value of that debt doesn't degrade. It actually continues to sit there. You've still got to repay it. And if incomes are not growing, it's very hard to find a way to repay it. So, yeah, we've got too much debt. As a result of that, we've got more households servicing more debt. We've got less ability for them to spend elsewhere. We've got businesses less able to invest. And so we've got this bit of a spiral going on in terms of the current economy. All of those things, I think, are actually playing in the wrong direction at the moment. And I fear that the net effect of all this is that the government and the RBA and APRA will try and encourage households to borrow even bigger and put even more debt on, because what they're trying to do is to kick the can down the road sufficiently to get to the next election. The chances are then that they'll lose the next election, that'll be Labour's problem. I think that's the strategy that we're now seeing playing out, right? So it's basically trying to keep the ball in the air sufficiently for the next couple of years up to the next election. It's a very, very tricky and, in my view, myopic strategy, and it's not what we need for quality leadership in the country, in my view. Ricky says, missed it, sorry, jumped out of me. I should explain that occasionally when I'm looking at a post, it jumps away because people put more comments down the bottom and it shoots up, so I have to just pull it back. Okay, Ricky said, when do you recommend purchasing property? I'm looking to put down 50% but can't justify purchasing property that are 30 to 50% overvalued. Okay, so the question is, Ricky, are you looking to buy property for somewhere to live or for an investment? That's the first question. If you're looking for property for an investment, tricky to see how in the current environment in property for investment purposes can work, because most of the issues relating to capital growth are under question at the moment. And the fact of the matter is that more than half of property investors are underwater on a cash flow basis, even now. And OK, rentals might be a little bit tighter than last month, but they're still way down and there's still plenty of property around. So property investment, I think, is probably, you know, not for some time. If you're looking to buy a property for somewhere to live, then it's a slightly different calculus, because basically if you can pay what you're paying now and, you know, maybe you're renting and effectively get a mortgage and then hold a property with a view for it being primarily somewhere to live, then that may be worthwhile. Remember that, of course, property prices may go up, they may come down. And that's the tricky part, right? Because if you've saved up a significant deposit and then you actually put it in and prices go down, you lose your deposit first. That's just the way that things work. And that's the very difficult situation that we're in. We're into, in some areas, a little bit of a rise in the short term, but then probably in the longer term, it'll come off again. So I think it's determined by why you want to buy. The second is what your time horizon is, because, you know, if you buy property and hold it for 10 or 15 years, you probably won't be doing too bad. But if you're looking at a 2 to 3 year horizon, there's so many uncertainties in that time frame that it may be worth just being a little bit more cautious. So I think it, frankly, it depends. And I've never said never buy property. I'm just saying go in with your eyes open. Remember that values can fall. Remember that if you own a property, you've got to actually pay all the other servicing costs like rates and power and those things. And you've got to be able to maintain the property too. So owning a property is a pretty costly experience. And again, if you add up all the costs of doing that in a low capital growth environment, many people would come out underwater. Cookie Boy quotes Tony LeCantro. Thanks, Cookie Boy. Good to see you. Tony LeCantro said, sell up now and hope some bigger idiot will pay more. Well, that's certainly happening in some areas. It's quite clear. We actually had a property down the road here sell, and it went for a much higher number than everybody expected because people from Sydney came down and bought it because from a Sydney perspective, it looked pretty good value. But frankly, it was way over the value locally. And all the locals just shook their heads saying, can't believe it. So you're right, bigger fool. Okay, next question is from, I can't pronounce that, I'm not even going to try, but it's a long name beginning with Lumin. Hi Martin, what about Brisbane? It could be a good time to buy a house where I'll be living in for the next 10 years at least. Yeah, I think in Brisbane, if you're buying a house, relatively close in, not in Toowoomba, but in Brisbane itself, there are some reasonably priced properties now. And the prospect are, because you haven't seen massive growth, you're not going to see massive drops probably in houses. Not units, units, very different story. But generally, my perspective would be that houses are a little more stable in and around Brisbane. And in fact, I've been talking to people quite recently who've done quite well because they have actually seen property values rise for houses in some areas. But, you know, be cautious in terms of future expectations of future price growth. Probably won't be a lot there. But hopefully, unless there's a massive international crisis, in one of my scenarios, you know, maybe it won't be too much on the downside. But you've got to understand there are risks involved in purchasing at these levels because of all the uncertainty we've touched on earlier on. Okay, just going down the list here. Talk about cycles. This is from 1920 to 2020. Yeah. If you take a longer term view, it's really interesting. There have been basically two periods where there was significant price growth over the last 100 years in Australia. The rest of the time, prices have pretty much gone, you know, pretty much sideways. And in each case, they were significant stimulus events. The most recent one, of course, because of the reduction in interest rates and all of those sorts of things and the deregulation of the financial system and those things. And the previous one was where there's significant migration post the war. The rest of the time, property prices have not tended to grow that much. So we have been lured into a false sense of security. And the number of people who say to me, property prices double every 7 years. Yeah, is that true? Is that really true? May have happened in the last few years in some places, but that's unusual. And there was a confluence of events. There was massive import of foreign buyers, particularly from China and elsewhere. There was extremely low interest rates. There was the loosening of financial standards. There was the deregulation of the financial system. There was the financialization of property and a bunch of other things, right? All going on at the same time. That's why we've got to where we've got to. We've got to the point where property is so overpriced, 40% overpriced in real terms. And now the government is effectively suggesting that we're going to take it even higher. I find that remarkable and rather worrying. Truth of the matter is, prices don't always go up. And I come from the UK, and in the UK, I was there long enough to see three significant falls in home prices. And in each time, prices dropped quite significantly and took a long time to recover. Prices can go down as well as up. And all of the spruiking that's going on at the moment from the media and from some other channels is remarkable given, one, the high level of debt, two, flat incomes, three, rising costs, and four, the local and international economic situation. And I keep coming back to my scenarios, right? The probability is that we're going to get worse economic news ahead than better economic news ahead. Reserve Bank said as much today. And so they're going to be really up against it to try and actually pull the levers to be able to actually keep the economy going. I can't see how this can actually end well, frankly. That's just another comment there from Genevieve. You're talking about traders. There's a lot of traders. I'm seeing it in my surveys. So a lot of traders 6 to 12 months ago were working 6 days, 7 days, plenty of work. Now they're working 3 days, 4 days, not many hours. And the number of traders now with forward pipelines of diminishing work over the next 6 months is remarkably high. I'm seeing that in pretty much every state and territory. The slight exception is Canberra, that seems to be keeping its own little bubble going a bit longer at the moment. Although even there, with 90% of new approvals for units, not houses, we're going to see, I think, an oversupply, and that's probably going to come off just a bit later. Public sector, you see, they've got bigger income, so they can afford more. So yeah, trade is big issue. I think we're going to see a lot more of that. Cookie Boy said, still waiting for the coot to do an interview with me. Well, I have invited him a couple of times, but you know, I can do no more. So I don't think he ever will, frankly. All right. Okay, so this is a GroovyMe1234 says, what would you do with 100k cash savings in these uncertain times? Well, look, my own view, this is not financial advice, this is what I've done. I've gone to cash. I think that there are too many uncertainties in the stock market and in the property market and indeed in the bond market. So I've chosen to sit in cash at the moment. I'm getting not flash returns, but I'm getting some returns. I've spread my risks, so I've basically used a number of smaller organisations rather than the big guys, and I'm sitting on it. I'm just waiting to see what happens because there are so many uncertainties, and I want to be in control. I want to be able to get out. Now, if in fact a cash ban were to come in, I might change my strategy, but that's what I've done at the moment. There are other people looking at alternatives, and one of the alternative causes metals, gold and silver, and there will be people on the channel. I know there'll be people on the channel saying, yeah, that's what you should be doing. The problem I've got is that metals, gold and silver, are traded in precisely the same way as the financial instruments. You've got those same international forces, and you've got all of those big speculators taking positions. You know, there are more derivatives than underlying of both gold and silver. And that means that the price is manipulated. You might have seen the JP Morgan thing recently where they were accused of manipulating the gold price. So I personally don't go gold, silver route. Others will, others do, but you have to make your own decision, I'm afraid. Okay, we're running close now, 9:15, so we've done quite a lot. I haven't yet got to any of my questions on the I've got beforehand. So if I don't get to the questions that I have got beforehand, I've got quite a few. What I'll do is I'll record a separate Q&A and put it up subsequently, because we're clearly quite a few people are asking questions which I want to take live. Gold, silver, cryptos, the LIBOR rates to reset by 2021. My thoughts on LIBOR. Well, of course, LIBOR is becoming less and less relevant because essentially it's being replaced by these other different things around the world. We have the BBSW, of course, here in Australia, and there are SONIA and others around the world. So LIBOR becomes less relevant, but there are lots of contracts still written in LIBOR terms. And so a lot of those are derivatives. And so there's an interesting question about what you do with those particular contracts. Do you unwind them and then effectively write new contracts under the new benchmark, be it, SONIA or whatever it is? Or do you find some a proxy to LIBOR as it disappears? This is a very important and a sleeper risk issue. And there have been a number of warnings from central banks and warnings from international regulators about the fact that companies should be thinking about what to do with LIBOR contracts, because at some point they're going to run out of runway. And I think it's one of those risks that hasn't really been thought through, and I think that the consequences are still quite serious. Okay, very interesting note there from Tony. My son is a money in transit guard. There is not enough physical cash daily to fill all the second class non-bank ATMs. That's interesting. I've certainly seen a diminishing of the number of ATMs and a diminishing in the stock to the ATMs. I think there is actually already some evidence of cash being sort of, you know, sucked out of the system. And in fact, you know, without getting into the M3, M1 debate, which was a question which I will answer separately, there's something weird going on in terms of the way the economy is working. Of course, more and more transactions are being electronic. But nevertheless, cash is still remains quite important. Banks are actually winding back their distribution via ATMs. And I've seen several ATMs removed from locales close to around here. And that's because the economics don't work. Less that's used costs more. But there's also something else. They've got to manage the cash and keep the cash topped up. I think we're going to see cash quietly pushed away as far as we can by the regulators, by the banks, you know, encouraged to use some digital alternatives, which is fine until the network goes down. And I don't remember whether you remember the last year Telstra, I think it was, dug a cable and all the FPOS machines in the country stopped working for a Saturday, I think it was. So unless you had cash, you couldn't go buy things. I still think that cash has a very important role to play in emergencies, has an important role to play in terms of where the technology doesn't get rich or in other situations. And so my concern is that the focus away from cash towards digital is we're leading us down a blind alley, I'm afraid. And I'm afraid that the lack of cash at the ATMs is just another symptom. Okay, what else have we got? This is from Harold. Do you think a stimulus spend can help us get out of the hole? Singapore and Korea developed high-tech industries. We've wasted our capital on roads, tunnels, dud NBN, pink bats. Yes, Harold, that's a really important point. There is no doubt that we have spent money on the wrong things. So the NBN's a classic example. Wrong technology backed when basically Turnbull came in and scrapped the connection directly to the house, you know, to these cabinets in the street. By the way, in the UK, BT are now basically being tasked with finally connecting households through fibre rather than via cabinets. Wrong decision, taken for the wrong reasons, for political ends, and we've ended up with a dud solution at a time when, of course, the wireless connectivity is getting ever better, and this looks like a big white elephant. By the way, I'm using the NBN tonight, and it functions reasonably well, so I'm not complaining, but I do have it connected directly to the house here. So, yeah, I think there have been many examples of dud spending, and frankly, things spent on, you know, well, things that should never have been spent on in the first place. Now, the question is, what's the alternative? Well, there is, of course, the idea of, you know, the government borrowing more because effectively rates are really low and using that to spend money to consumers directly or indirectly, whether it's a universal income or whether it's some sort of other stimulus. Those are one set of strategies. But I think that the right strategies would be to have a very strong focus on future investment and innovation. And I think we've really lost the plot here in terms of you know, new business industries. What is the industrial base of Australia going to look like in 10, 15, 20 years' time? It can't be mining and coal and oil and LNG. It's got to be something else, right? And we, unless we actually invest now for that future, we're not going to have any plan B. So that's what I'd be looking at. And I would be, you know, backing essentially some startups and backing some innovation. And I'd be perhaps trying to leverage some international relationships as well. Maybe the space race is one example of that. But we've really left it very, very late. And we seem to be so myopic and so short-term. You know, the politics is short-termism, partly because of the short election cycles and partly because everyone's very tactical. But we need vision, I think, firstly, and we need the ability to be able to actually think beyond that and think about some of the broader opportunities that are there. So I agree. But I'm not sure that giving money helicopter-wise to households is necessarily the right answer. Evidence has shown that quite often people actually, you know, pay off loans or do other things, and it's then gone. So we need to find a way to invest in the future. And I highlight Norway, whose oil investment created a fund that is still there and is supporting them through the evolution of their economy, even as oil becomes less relevant to them. Gold, silver, cryptos, thanks for your response, Libra. Hope that was all right. Yeah. I may do a separate post on that, because it's a really interesting conversation to have. Be having more detail than I can really do here. Okay. Mark says, exactly, it would take 5 to 10 years to create a new diversity in our economy. Well, exactly. But we've got to start, right? We should have started a decade ago. We should have actually really started taking those first steps. I said a decade ago when I was giving an interview to Stephen Long, the ABC, one of the economists at the ABC. I said, we're a one-trick pony. We need to actually develop some new stuff. That was a decade ago. And I had the conversation with him a couple of months ago when I recorded another interview. And guess what? It was the same conversation. We still haven't learned that lesson, I'm afraid. And so Sovereign Borders says we can't have innovation and ingenuity without a manufacturer. Yeah, I agree. We have to make things. We have to make things of value. Digging up iron ore and throwing it out, you know, without any processing or value add is, you know, a very worrying strategy. We need to actually be looking for the value adds, I think. I agree with that. Okay, well, we're at 9:24, so what I'm going to do is going to just go through a few last slides, and I'll come back and just check for any last questions. As with all of the often fine, not enough time to cover everything, but hopefully it's been an interesting conversation. So just a few closing remarks here. Firstly, you can get a lot more information on the DFA blog. We do publish daily on the blog, a lot of information there. You can subscribe and get more information. Do you recommend you do that if you're interested in our research and what we talk about? You can also support our work. There are various mechanisms. Just to explain again, DFA is doing this not to make money, not for profit, right? We make nothing overall from doing this. What we're doing this, we passionately believe this is a really critical issue that we're dealing with, and we want to help people understand more about what's going on so that effectively people are better prepared and better able to deal with the issues that they have to face. And we don't think the mainstream media is doing a good enough job in telling the full story, which is why we do what we do. That costs. So one thing you can do is to actually support us via Patreon on a monthly basis. There are different tiers and levels. And those at the higher tiers get access to some exclusive content. For example, a longer version of the interview that I posted yesterday is up on Patreon for those at some tiers, which goes into much more detail in some of those discussion points. So have a look at that if that's of interest. Greatly appreciated. We've got more subscribers again, and the number keeps growing. It really is encouraging and helps us to do what we do. Or you can make a one-off donation via PayPal. Some people do that, and I really appreciate that. And the combination of donations from PayPal and from Patreon over the last couple of years helped us to buy the new switcher, which I'd made a video on the other day. And we're starting now to use that to create more professional content. And you'll see more of that in the live stream events that we run down the track as we get it fully installed. It's quite a big, complicated exercise, but watch for more on that. We even have Bitcoin, so there are people who actually prefer contributions via Bitcoin. I'll be honest with you, not many, but some people have used Bitcoin. Again, thank you. Any contribution, anyway, is greatly received and, you know, hugely appreciated, as are the Super Chat contributions as well. It just helps to cover some of the costs of what we're doing here. And just to explain, the surveys that we run are covered by the selling of those surveys to our end clients. So none of the contributions from the DFA channel go back to cover the cost of the survey. It all goes on to making more content for you. And just a few quick final points. The DFA October market update, that's the one I put up yesterday. That was my trip up to Sydney, including the train trip and the and the rather arty shots from the escalator, which some people like, some people hate it, but I don't care. I quite enjoyed doing it. But also a big discussion there with fund managers and hedge funds about what's going on in Australia. There's also the Property Imperative Weekly. I should say to you that I will be reviewing shortly whether, in fact, I continue with the imperative weekly updates, because it's a lot of effort now to make them really sort of work. And at the moment, the audience is not as big as it was. So if you are not interested, or if you find that the imperative is too complex or too long, let me know, and perhaps I'll try something different. There's a post called Spring Has Not Sprung. That's to do with the low levels of listings, very significantly down, and will continue. I think we're going to see more of that. On the Interest of the People channel, there's Australia's Debt Bubble is Falling Apart. That's actually now one of my most popular posts with John Adams on that other channel, and that's where we went through some of the latest stats on what's happening with regard to the debt bubble. Joe Wilkes and I made a post on baby boomers and the monetary policy and how it's supporting them or not. Joe and I will be doing some more stuff. And by the way, we are thinking of running some events in New Zealand, probably early in the new year, with Joe and maybe Robbie Barwick and John Adams. So if there is enough interest, that's what we'll do. We've already had quite a lot of interest expressed from our New Zealand audience. So, you know, tell us if you would like to be involved in some way, and we'll try and cook something up. And I will just then highlight the data analysis, probably frontline post. That's the one with the REA chief economist. That's where we went into the question of how much home prices have gone up. That's been a very popular post too. So that's just a few examples. Okay, so let me just come back finally to the posts and just see whether there are any final comments before we close off. Very, very, very interesting conversations tonight. Thank you for all those questions. We've had nearly 800 on, so that's tremendous again, big numbers. And I've been very appreciative of the various comments and conversations that have gone on there. As Ron Brumell says, R&D reduced. Yeah, I agree. Crazy, poor government policy. Doesn't make any sense. So many things I could talk about in terms of poor policy. Gold, silver, cryptos. If you have too much work on your own, will you hire someone to help you? Well, yeah, maybe, but there's a lot of complexity to that. I have people who work on an occasional basis with me. I'll review this as I go forward in terms of how it goes. And, you know, I wasn't sure when I started doing this last year whether this would be a short thing or whether we will continue to develop the channel. You know, we'll be close to 30,000 viewers and subscribers within a month or two, which is remarkable from where we started just over a year, 18 months ago. So I'll be reviewing some of that. And I've got a few thoughts in terms of how we can make it work. But partly the tech that I invested in recently will help, because it will just simplify a lot of different things too. Tony says, thank you for what you do, and much love and prayers still for your wife. Yeah, thank you. Tony, yeah, she is better, thank you. She's still recovering from major ops and other things, and she's still very tired, but she's a little better than she was. In fact, we are having some more scans in a couple of weeks' time, and we'll then know what the status is beyond, you know, whether it's going to be able to be something which will be in recession for some time, or whether it will actually not. So the next few weeks, your prayers will be greatly appreciated. Thank you. Okay. Positively Geared Property says Art A. Any thoughts? Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? It becomes an interesting scenario. I'll probably do a separate post on that, because there's a lot of I can talk about, but probably not in the last minute or so of the show. Mining Star says, let me come to your show and tell Ozzy to stop being sheeps. Yeah, we'd like people to think for themselves. Yeah, well, I agree. Yes, that's very good. Okay. Okay, so I think we're there. I want to say thank you all very much for spending the time with me today. I hope you found it useful. Apologies for not getting to all the questions in beforehand. I will record a separate show and put them up subsequently. But, you know, I think the fact of the matter is the live conversation and live chat's pretty good. And I'll answer the Positive Gear question in the separate post. So thank you very much indeed for spending time with me today. We'll talk again in a month's time. And in the meantime, have a great evening. And thank you for your support. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. See you next time.